Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation with Leo Laporte, episode 49, recorded at the NAB Show 2012 in Las Vegas on Wednesday, April 18th, 2012. Byron Reese and Greg Panos. Triangulation is brought to you by Stamps.com. Use Stamps.com to buy and print real U.S. postage using your own computer and printer whenever you need it. You'll never have to go to the post office again. For my special $110 bonus offer, go to Stamps.com today and use the offer code TRIANGULATION. And by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. Hello and welcome. Leo Laporte here, a special edition of Triangulation today. We're here at the National Association of Broadcasters show, NAB 2012, having a great time. I hope you've been watching our coverage all week long. And since I knew there'd be some really interesting people to talk to here, I thought, let's do Triangulation from the show floor. And man, did we snag two, not one, but two great interviews. We're going to start off with Byron Reese, who is a chief innovation officer at Demand Media, but that's not what you're going to talk about today. Byron, it's nice to meet you.
Good to meet you.
We've been having a great conversation before the show began about big data and why the world is going to be a better place. Hallelujah.
That's right.
You know, we get a lot of people on who are very grim and bleak about the future. In fact, a lot of us feel kind of grim, but you don't have that message.
Not at all. In fact, I think a better tomorrow isn't just possible. I think it is actually all but inevitable at this point. I mean, you know,
barring, we won.
That's right. No, barring the stray, you know, asteroid. It's the cards. You can already see it all about
because of digital technology, Moore's law.
All together. I mean, you start by saying the most vexing problems humanity has are fundamentally technological problems. You have disease, which is nothing but technology. You have poverty. You have hunger. You have ignorance, which is kind of its own special class, and you have war, and everything except maybe war, you can argue is just technological. And if it is a technological problem, then almost definitionally it has a technological solution.
There aren't problems that have no solution. I'll give you an example. We're going to run out of water. Water is going to be a critical resource going forward.
That's all hinging on the idea of scarcity. And scarcity, yes. We're about to see the end of scarcity. You take something like water or energy, and I'll come back to water. You take something like energy. Do you think energy is a scarce resource?
Absolutely not, because we get it from the sun.
Sure.
And ultimately, all energy comes from the sun.
Right. There's massively more than we need. We just don't know how to harvest it.
That I'll agree is a technological problem.
Water. There's the same number of water molecules today as there were
10,000
years ago.
We're not losing water.
Exactly. It's just a technological problem how to solve for it.
Let's talk about disease, because there are systems like the human body that are so complex, they're chaotic systems, that perhaps they're not, I guess they're ultimately deterministic, but perhaps they're not sufficiently definable that you could solve the problem.
You have to say, what killed, you know, smallpox in its last year of existence, last 100 years of existence, killed more people than all the wars of the 20th century.
We
made a vaccine for that. Wow. In the 1700s, without even any understanding of germ theory. You take something like polio. Salk made a polio vaccine with no, he didn't have genetic mapping. He didn't know what the genome was. And so these guys were tackling that level of problem.
At a low technology.
Stone knives and bearskins, basically. And so are you really telling me that we're not going to be able to beat back influenza or dysentery or all of these other things?
And in fact, the evidence is that we are good at this. There are setbacks occasionally, but generally we're looking at amazing progress in the last century.
And so I think ignorance, I actually would even spend a moment on that one, because if you think of all of the decisions that the people have made that have had catastrophic results that were foreseeable and avoidable, essentially, we're not really good as a species of having a memory, of a learning memory. We do things and we kind of forget them. And then we kind of have to relearn them. And because of more and more data being passively recorded by sensors everywhere, as a byproduct of all these things we want computers to do, our species is about to have a very robust memory and basically a recording of every cause and effect, every cause and effect, every cause and effect.
You have more data points. You can solve any problem.
And you'll basically make everybody on the planet wiser than the wisest person who's ever lived, because they'll have access to the life experience of everybody who's alive.
We're kind of seeing that right now. The internet puts at our fingertips stuff that we'd have years ago. We would have to go to the library and maybe we'd find it. We could find out anything in seconds now.
Yes. I mean, but think about, Amazon's good at recommending books to you based on other people and what they've bought.
Right.
So that's this tiny spot. Is that approach, we don't have the data for it, but is that approach not equally as valid for where you should go to college or what profession you should go into?
If you had enough data.
Exactly. And we're getting where we're recording it all.
Right.
You know, I always wanted this. Every time I get some symptom, I go on the internet and I type my symptom in. I think like everybody does. And it always comes back, I either have Lou Gehrig's disease or a brain tumor, right?
Right.
And you know, I see that in the search results and I'm like,
not very good.
No. And the thing is what I wanted to do was start this website where you type your symptoms in and it says, here's the deal. I'll tell you what you're likely to have. But in a month, you got to tell me what it turned out to be. And then all of a sudden, I get this feedback loop. And then I
can. That's what you need.
Exactly. In 0.1% of the case, you have Lou Gehrig's disease.
And yet, are these things not more difficult to solve than we thought? For instance, I think of ELISA. I think of Turing test machines, Turing test failures. Those recommendation engines work sort of, but not. They're not great. Sometimes I think we think that we have a higher hopes for computation than we really ought to. I think of things like voice recognition, handwriting recognition. All of these things turn out to be more difficult than we thought they were going to be.
But is your point they've turned out to be impossible?
No, we don't know yet. But right. It's hard to say that there's this linear progress. It seems like we've come up against some stone walls in many cases.
Is that true? Do you think voice recognition isn't making more progress? And
it seems stalled for a while, but you're right, it's changed
but,
now.
But I would say this. It's what I said earlier, that the native in Tanzania with a cell phone has more better communication capability than Ronald Reagan had when he was president.
That's kind of amazing, isn't it?
And you look at the shape of that curve, and everything we know says it's going to get steeper.
Right.
And I
so is Ray Kurzweil right? Are we headed toward a singularity where this because of big data, because of smarter computational devices, the machines finally achieve awareness?
I'm a big fan of Ray's. I read everything he writes and think he's just brilliant beyond belief. But I don't think... I don't agree that that is what will happen. I think it's a mistake to say when a computer has the computational power of my brain, it effectively becomes like me anymore.
There's something ineffable that makes us human.
I think that it's that difference between the brain and the mind. I mean,
progress isn't kind of infinite and it's going to continue forever. There are discontinuities. There are places to which you cannot achieve. Are there not?
Such as? What do you mean?
Humanity.
Well, I think that is in fact the ultimate thing.
And isn't humanity the ultimate problem we have?
Because no, not at
war,
all.
Ignorance, yeah. Pestilence. We could solve many problems. There's plenty of food to go around. It's a distribution issue.
Actually, that's an interesting question. An interesting thing. I had this book coming out that says we're going to see the end of hunger. And it turns out, actually, that there's about 800-900 million hungry people in the world. And if you look at the number one country they live in, it's India. Well, surprisingly, India is massively a net food exporter.
Yeah.
And then number two
bizarre.
Is China.
That's bizarre.
China is massively a net food exporter.
Yeah.
Number three is Pakistan, net food exporter. And so it
actually, I don't understand.
Well, no,
they're hungry, but they're exporting their food.
Because they can sell it for more than their people can afford to pay for it.
So the problem is not the people, not the food, lack of food. It's the problem is people who are running the place.
Well, The fundamental problem is in the modern age, you starve to death not if you don't have food, but if you don't have money, and that's basically because
not
we don't
a lack
regard
of food, yeah.
food as a human right.
Yeah,
and that's an interesting thing because we somehow say you have the right to life, but it's like but you don't have the right to a heart,
eat or get medical care or
in any case.
Let me ask you though, that's the problem. Is humans are the problem?
I don't agree. I don't agree. I think that what has happened is there are. All of these things, we're always going to have trouble getting along. You have trouble getting along with your family members, right?
And yeah. Yeah.
So we're always going to
have
trouble.
That's why there'll always be war.
No, I don't believe that. I don't believe that. And we could spend an hour talking about that. I think what happens is all these other problems make those a lot worse. You know, the
lack of resources really is what causes
desperation,
war.
Poverty,
yeah.
Hunger.
Yeah. Yeah.
What's going to happen with war? All these things are changing. In my book, I give 50 reasons there will be no war in the future. And one of them is simply that business accomplishments have replaced our notion of achievement for men over military accomplishments.
And thank God.
Yes, absolutely. Second is the value of targets has gone way up. They say if Tokyo got leveled, it would be $8 trillion to rebuild. And so, you know, that's a big disincentive for Tokyo, you know, Japan not to go into war.
No more 30 seconds over Tokyo. It's too expensive.
Exactly. And so it's much more, peace becomes much more affordable. Third, as wealth levels rise and everybody gets an iPod and a comfortable life and all of that, their tendency to want to wage war with their neighbors declines.
You know, you see this in China. It's very interesting. In fact, the ruling parties in China were smart enough to give the poorest people in China the one or two luxury commodities that they really wanted, air conditioning in one decade, cars in another decade. It was enough to keep them quiet. It was enough to satisfy them. And in fact, they've raised the standard of living gradually to the point where they have almost, you know, a peasant society that is becoming middle class. And it's a very interesting way of solving unrest.
I think if you believe technology creates wealth, and the rate of technology is creating, is expanding, I think you're going to see worldwide GDP go up tenfold very quickly.
Fascinating.
And then what we know, it's very interesting, if you look at any country across time, or all countries in a moment in time, as people get more income, guess what they choose to spend it on? More government. And that's why the richest nations have a larger percentage of their income goes into taxes than the poorest nations. And so what people want to do is buy more government. It's very odd to think of it that way, but they want better roads and they want,
right.
And then they redefine poverty upwards and then they make sure nobody lives under that poverty line.
Right.
So even if this newfound wealth is disproportionately allocated to the rich,
which it will be,
portion of it will be taxed and used as kind of a technology dividend.
And the bottom line goes up.
It does, which also just lessens all the pressure on all these other problems.
We're talking to Byron Reese. If you're just joining us, and I know we cut in a little late from the studio, he is a fascinating fellow. His day job, or maybe it's his night job, I don't know, Chief Innovation Officer at Demand Media, but he was here to speak at the NAB Military and Government Summit, just back from, believe it or not, North Korea, as of yesterday. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And he has just finished his book, which will be out this fall, Golden Age 2.0, How the Internet Will End Ignorance, Disease, Hunger, Poverty, and War.
Right.
Good news. He's actually the first optimist we'd ever had on Triangle. No, actually, you know what? The smartest people are often optimists, which surprises me.
Well, it does it, because the lesson of history the last 10,000 years is that things get better. We end slavery. We end torture for entertainment. We end women as chattel. We end debtors' prisons. We cure more diseases. We have less people in abject poverty. We no longer cruelly torture animals for our amusement. I mean, everything people look at, they see nothing but 10,000 years of progress, and yet, therefore, they conclude things must be about to get worse.
I think we're waiting for the other shoe to drop.
I think so, at some level.
And I think also it's easy to forget that and focus on what's still bad, what's still wrong, and that may be just a human trait.
The thing is we've created this thing called civilization, and that really is the crowning achievement of humanity. And it must be nurtured.
And it's only 10,000 years old.
Exactly, and it must be It's not innate. We have to pass it down. But what we're learning is how to make it better and better and better and better.
But wasn't the 20th century the bloodiest century in the history of mankind? More died in wars than ever before. I mean, can you say we've made progress in that regard? We've made progress in killing.
That is true. That our ability to kill, that history is depressingly void of examples of weapons being made and not used.
Yeah.
And I think that is this anomalous hiccup where technology got our ability to destroy, you know, like in the Star Trek style.
It's Star Trek.
Exactly. Our ability, the prime directive, right? We got nukes too early, and now we're in this pickle.
But that doesn't mean that will be solved too, you believe?
I think once you lessen all the pressure off all of these other issues, and standard of living's rise, yeah, and all these other factors, our propensity to wage war will plummet.
Byron Reese is our guest. By the way, if you want a fun thing to do, and once you get started, plan a couple of hours looking at it, his website is byronreese.com. And it is a timeline not just of our thoughts about the future from the past, but going into the future, our thoughts about the future also from the past. Things like Blade Runner 1984. I love this. Logan's Run. This is a site you will browse, and it's beautiful. You really did a nice job. It's really beautiful.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
And fascinating to think about, and lots of stuff that I didn't know. For instance, we all focus on that famous picture of the big blue marble that NASA brought us of the Earth, and that was kind of thought to be the first time we thought of ourselves as one planet. And yet, in 1948, we in fact had a rocket's eye view of the planet that was the first time we ever saw the actual curvature of the Earth. And that was in 48. Fascinating stuff. ByronReese.com. We'll come back with more with Byron a little later on. My good friend Gregory Panos will join us to talk about how they did that Tupac hologram at Coachella. You probably haven't seen this video. Mm-mm. Tupac Shakur back from the dead in the most creepy way possible. But first, let's talk about stamps, right? Stamps.com, is that what's next? All right. I don't go to the post office. And this is why the world is getting better. You don't have to ever again either. Technology, you know, you're right, Byron. Technology has eliminated the need to go to the post office. You can print your own stamps with your own computer and your own printer at stamps.com. What will they think of next? Actually, it baffles me that everybody doesn't just do this. It changed my life when I stopped going to the post office. Go to stamps.com right now. And this also baffles me. We've got for you an amazing deal. Now, if you go to stamps.com, you'll see this $80 offer. No, don't do that. Click the radio microphone, you know, that fin microphone, and type in triangulation. Watch this. That $80 offer, when I click go, is going to turn. This is a magic trip worthy of Brian Brushwood. It's going to turn into, yes, a $110 bonus offer, $55 free postage, a free digital scale. You just pay shipping and handling for the scale, a $5 supply kit, and a four-week trial of stamps.com. You know why they can do this? Because they know once you do it, you will be a customer for life, as I am. Print your own U.S. postage for packages, for letters, whatever you need. You just plop it on that USB scale. It tells you exactly what you need, always up to date, Mac or PC. You've got the postage, and now a uniformed representative of the federal government will come to your home and collect that package, a.k.a. the mail carrier. In fact, you can even schedule free pickups anytime. Packages of any size. It's fantastic. Stamps.com. Remember, click the radio microphone in the upper right-hand corner. Use the offer code triangulation, and you'll get a $110 bonus offer, $55 free postage. Why wouldn't you do this? Why wouldn't you do this? Stamps.com. Our guest today on Triangulation, you know what? I'm going to have... The next time you're back from North Korea and you have a little more time, I'd love to spend more time talking with you because half an hour is clearly not enough. Why is big data important? You kind of alluded to this a little bit, but let's talk a little bit more about this because this seems to be one of the hot topics in technology is big data. Well, first of all, what is big data?
Well, I think the world is about to get blanketed with sensors because the cost of them is falling dramatically. And it isn't done by any central organization. It's a byproduct of all these things we want computers to do. Like, I want a camera mounted above my front door that scans the face of everybody to see if they're like a criminal who comes to my door. I want my skillet to remember everything I ever cook in it.
Right.
I want my spoon to measure the caloric content of every spoonful of food I take.
You know what? There's a barrier to this, though. People are going crazy right now because of privacy concerns.
Right.
That's a real barrier to
this. I think so. It's something we're going to have to work through. But just... As a thought experiment, just assume you collect your own data for your own use. Just
and
like,
nobody else gets it.
Exactly. Just start with that. Just like with Netflix.
Right.
It recommends videos to me based on things I've selected in the past. And so you start thinking about that. What if everything about you was recorded? A true digital echo of your life. Every time your heart beat, everything your eye tracked to, everything. And that is the bigness of big data, and it's incomprehensibly big.
Is this kind of what Gordon Bell was talking about with his, wasn't it, it was a Memex. He has a camera hung around his neck that takes pictures of everything.
Yes.
But that's just kind of the smallest amount.
That is
and isn't it really true that it's mostly valuable, not if it's just recording your stuff and my stuff independently, but if when we merge that.
Well, that's the thing.
That's where it really becomes valuable.
You asked me about anonymity.
That's where, yeah.
I'm very interested in things we have created the internet to do that have no offline corollary, because those are things that tell us a lot about ourselves.
Search engines have no, really.
Twitter.
Twitter, yeah.
And one thing that was a surprise about the internet, and this ties back, is the degree to which people will go out of their way for a total stranger, for nothing no hope of anything in return. If you post some problem you have in a forum, somebody will write you an
amazing
answer. I know. And
often
it means,
with really good information.
It means we have an innate desire to help people.
We're altruistic.
I think so. And I believe that people will, if they believe their anonymity is protected, they'll willingly share the digital echo of their life to improve the algorithms that make everybody's life better.
You know, we have a good example of that with 23andMe, where you give them your genome, a small bit of it anyway. You give them a swab, and they give you information. But it's most valuable because they collate the information anonymously from everybody and get really a great database of stuff.
Right.
And we do that. We know that our stuff is not 100% private. Then there's the Personal Genome Project, which goes one step further and says, we're not even going to attempt to make it private. In order for this to be valuable, it has to be public.
Open source, right.
Yeah, and I volunteered, and Esther Dyson's volunteered. A lot of people volunteered their data for this Personal Genome Project altruistically.
I think people will. And what happens is it means we all become part of the solution to creating essentially the algorithms that maximize our life potential.
Should people not worry about privacy?
I don't want to tell anybody what they should worry about.
Right.
If they're worried
about
it.
But there is an upside to sharing this stuff.
We do know that the younger you are, the less worried about it you are. So whether they should or shouldn't worry, the fact is people are less...
That's going to go this way.
Right.
Yeah.
It's like this, I don't know anybody, you know, under 30 who wears a watch. You know, it's a single function device.
It's like this, the thing I don't have.
Exactly. And so it will all change organically. Nobody has to change their mind, I think, just as people age. And so, as I was saying earlier, it essentially makes a collective memory of the planet. We all become part of the solution. Everything you learn in your life will in some way help somebody else live a better life. And that is the end of ignorance. That really is. You make the optimal decision based on the sum total of all human knowledge, which is perfectly recorded for eons to come.
If we only knew enough about how the weather works or how our bodies work, we could solve any problem.
Well, there is a logical limit to it at some level, but I don't know what that level is. And
it's a lot higher than we are now.
Well, that's the thing is, I believe this, that the rate of technological change is so fast, we are approaching this first time we can do almost anything. We could do almost anything. And the question is, what are we going to do? And our propensity is going to be to aim too low because we still are locked in this mindset.
It can't be that
exactly.
Good.
And the thing I would urge people to do is imagine the kind of world we wish we lived in and actually all work to make that world a reality.
And instead of assuming the worst, maybe we should start thinking that we can actually do the best.
I am really scratching my head how people aren't optimistic. I mean, like I said, 10,000 years of it, and everything is only getting easier and better.
There are people in the chat room saying, it's just temperamentally you, Byron, an idealist. I think it's iPad Rick who said, an idealist is somebody who believes in the perfectibility of people in society. Do you believe that?
No, not at all. Not at all. We're always going to have personal conflict. I mean, there are two kinds of optimists. There are people who hope the future's better.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are the people who reason that it will be better.
And that's what you're doing.
I believe
based
so.
Based on what we're seeing, we're making huge progress.
Yes.
Things are better than they've ever been.
And it is accelerating.
Fascinating stuff. ByronReese.com. The book comes out in the fall?
I think December. I know.
You know what they can't perfect?
I know. What's that all about?
You finished it, right?
I know.
You wrote it, right?
2 weeks later, it should be on the shelves, but it evidently doesn't work that way. Trees have to be cut down.
Trees are being harvested right now. To print Byron's book. Do go to the website, though. You can read a lot of that here. There. Anywhere else we can find out more? If you have white papers or articles that you've written?
Everything
I want to know more.
Everything is there or either linked to from there.
Excellent. And I want you to come back. I don't want to wait till December, but as soon as you want to talk about the book, please do come back. It's been
thank you so much.
Real
it's
pleasure meeting you. Thank you. Byron Reese. Take care. I said, what do you want to talk about? You want to talk about demand media? He said, no. I want to talk about the future because it's so bright. Let's thank you, Byron. We're going to let Byron go, and we're going to bring in Gregory Panos. This is a special edition of Triangulation. First of all, no Tom Merritt. I decided we'll do three people, but it'd be me and two guests. We'll be back to our normal mode next week. We're live right now at the National Association of Broadcasters show, the NAB show in Las Vegas, Nevada, where we've been having a great time. Still more coverage. Just two more hours, though. Actually, I take it back. Right after this, We're going to go to the ham radio party. Scott Wilkinson, Kirk Harnack, and Bob Heil will be there. That is always a great event. If you're a ham or you just want to see some hams having a good time, you must watch for that. Tomorrow, 9-11, Scott Wilkinson will be back here in our Sky booth with our final coverage from the NAB show. We've been having a great time, and it's really been just, I think, fascinating. This is a show for content creators, and we're seeing so many interesting things. We're going to talk about a unique kind of content creation in just a bit with Greg Panos. But first, let me remind you about one of our sponsors. They're big here. They're very popular, maybe because they were handing out beer. I'm talking about Pond5, the world's stock media marketplace. Go to P-O-N-D and the number 5.com. Pond5 is both a place that buys content and sells content. It's a marketplace, right? Buys and sells. It's a marketplace. If you go there right now, you'll see they have a million video clips you can buy very affordably. Prices start at just $5 for stock video and music. They have 7.6 million photos. They have 680,000 illustrations, 76,000 music tracks, 250,000 sound effects. They start at just $2 each. And these are royalty-free. That means when you buy, they're yours to use in any of your productions, your family videos, whatever it is you're up to. You just use this clip art, these videos, and they're going to enrich everything you do, your PowerPoint presentations. I mean, imagine putting that in a PowerPoint presentation, ladies and gentlemen. Salsa Lady, $15, 1080p. It could be yours today. I've got an even better deal. By the way, if you're a content creator, this is a great place to sell. Pond5 has the best royalties in the business. You get to set your own price. They split it with you 50-50. So that's amazing. But here's the really amazing deal. Go to www.pond5.com, and I want you to enter this URL, www.pond5.com/twit, and you'll get 50, count them, 50. See, every time I mention this, gosh darn it, everybody goes there at once. Wait a minute. You know, in some ways I don't mind because it tells Pond5 somebody's watching this ad. Wait a minute and go there. Pond5, there it is. www.pond5.com/twit. 50 clip art segments for you. They're absolutely free. We thank them so much. They've been such a great supporter. Such a great supporter during our NAB broadcast, I gave them an extra ad. How about that? Pond5.com. Let's say hello to our next guest. This is a special edition of Triangulation. Three legs in the stool, but not me and Tom Merritt and a guest. It's me and two guests. Gregory Panos, great to see you. I met you first a couple of years ago. Maybe it was at CES a couple of years ago. And we have some kind of first time I'd ever met you, but we have a lot in common. Get that mic. You know what, Greg? You're going to have to get that really in your face.
All right.
Because I used to do a virtual character of some renown on MSNBC called Dev Null on the show called The Site. And you worked with this company, Protozoa, that made that character possible.
That's right. Yeah, I know the one of the founders, Brad DeGraff.
Yeah, yeah. And I think back to then, that was 1996, 16 years ago. I had to wear a rubber suit with dots on it, and I had special headgear on, and it used a $500,000 computer, Silicon Graphics Onyx.
Right, Reality Engine.
The Reality Engine to take the data from my movement into that thing and animate it, but it was able to do real-time animation. I was sitting across from Soledad O'Brien. I was a virtual barista, and the funniest thing is our producer here on the show floor today is Karsten Bondi, the guy who spun my hair. Anyway, we've come a long way, and one of the things you and I talked about when I first met you was we could do much the same thing with an off-the-shelf PC today.
Oh, yeah.
We've come a long way.
Yeah. So nowadays they perfected the sensing of the voice, and they perfected the facial and mouth models, so you can just speak into a microphone and it'll animate your mouth.
No more puppeteers?
Yeah, well, it depends on the character.
And how elaborate,
I
guess.
12 arms, a spider, you can have a couple of other people puppeteering the other arms.
So your expertise is, tell me a little bit about yourself. Your expertise is in graphics, 3D?
Yeah, you know, I'm a futurist at this point. I got a degree in TV production and direction.
Isn't that funny?
So I was directing TV
at a PBS station
when I was in college, and I had the opportunity to go into the big network, and I just decided that the big network and the union thing in New York was just seemed too constraining, and I was just discovering computer animation. So I polished myself up and presented myself to a couple of the companies that were doing work in the area. There were three of them in New York, three top computer animation facilities. And I worked at each one for a period of time, initially helping them do marketing. And I eventually landed at the New York Institute of Technology Computer Graphics Laboratory, where all the founders from Pixar were basically running that lab before they left to join George Lucas. And I was there for about another year after they left and came out to California and kind of stuck with the computer graphics business for a while and ended up at Rockwell International in the Space Station Division.
You were doing simulations for the...
Right. So we were doing a lot of the preliminary designs for the space station using all like Silicon Graphics Reality Engine type real-time hardware to fly around and show all the NASA... executives and the design engineers what it would like to do a flyby of a space station or different kinds of space station designs. And the lab that I was in, we decorated it and made it like a TV editing suite. So we had carpets and pin beams and music.
You felt at home.
Nice soft chairs. And the NASA executives used to always come in and they'd say, "Wow, you've got the coolest job in the whole company. This is the nicest area in the whole building I've been in. This is better than the executive's office." So the executives were always stopping by, and I was giving them dog and pony
That's
shows.
A good way to get executives interested in what you're up to, actually. Yeah. Make it comfortable for
well,
them.
You know, there's certain to be said for sex appeal as far as giving a promotion.
Absolutely,
is
absolutely. CGI has come a long way. I know you worked on The Lawnmower Man. You did the virtual reality simulations for that movie, right?
Well, I was a consultant to the producer and the director, and at the time I was working on some designs for virtual reality equipment that we would use to for space station. And
were these those big helmets that you people?
Yeah,
put on?
We were using visor based displays and
whatever happened.
The ring that they had that they were spinning around in was a design that I was working on, and I
so that was that. Actually from something you were working on.
Well, yeah, they took a lot of various people's things that were being presented to them into account when they made that film. So, not really sure how much was mine or somebody
right.
else's.
Right.
I didn't really care.
Right.
My.
You think they got it right?
My fascination was in making sure that I did a brain dump on these people, so they could at least get something right.
They knew everything that you knew. So what happened though to virtual reality? I look at Jaron Lanier now, and he's like arguing against being into technology practically. You are not a gadget.
He's an interesting guy.
Did VR fail in the same way that AI kind of failed?
Did VR fail?
Yeah.
No, VR is embedded in many, many fields right now, in medicine and in research and in military.
People do surgery with virtual reality.
Yeah, telesurgery. Yep. There's the Da Vinci company makes a telesurgical robot that's very expensive, that's extremely accurate and extremely reliable. It can be operated remotely.
I guess I thought that someday it would be kind of a consumer product where I could walk around in Paris, you know, in my virtual reality world and think I was there and... I know, we all want the holodeck, don't
yeah.
we?
Well, I built quite a few virtual reality systems myself, but from scratch. And I brought them to trade shows, and I spoken at 100 conferences about VR. But I always had them give me a booth, and I brought my people, and I set it up at the booth. And everybody was always lined up to try VR. So many people had never tried it before. They've always heard about it.
Right.
So each year I would upgrade my system, and I'd go to NAB or Comdex or CES
or SIGGRAPH
snore the equipment out of all the various manufacturers to try to get the upgrades going and make a list of materials of how I built the VR system and give that away at the conference and put people through VR.
You were kind of the Steve Wozniak of virtual reality.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to wire a lot of stuff together myself.
Yeah, yeah.
I was also into wearable computing pretty early on. I built a very early wearable computer prototype with a flip-down display based on the reflection technology private eye.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on, because this augmented reality is starting to become a reality, if you will. We've seen the Google glasses. Google's talking about that. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you your opinion of this. This is something we saw Sergey Brin in public wearing. Google made a kind of a faked up video about what the glasses might be and even said, we'll probably have them for sale later this year. Is that possible?
Oh, absolutely. If you just look at the people that they hired, the credentials of the people that they hired into that lab specifically for that project, and you look at some of the patent filings and some of the patents that those people have filed in previous jobs that they've had elsewhere, it's pretty obvious he's putting a team together to accomplish that.
They're serious.
Yeah. And
they say they can sell them for less than $600. Does that seem doable?
I think with today's technology and massive scale, they could do that.
And maybe a smartphone in your pocket that's providing some of the computational
power. They're
going
to have to spend a couple of $100 million to be able to produce systems and that will sell for $600 to $1,000.
Right.
But it's all doable. And
how about the display? How would that work? Is it heads up? Do I have to look into a screen?
Well, I think what they're using in the design studies that you've been seeing, the variations of various configurations mm-hmm. of models wearing them, they're using a little glass cube, which has a MEMS display or a micro OLED display that reflects onto like a mirror at an angle. And you can see through this little display and you can see everything.
It's like a teleprompter.
Right, like a mini teleprompter.
So I would look up into the display, or is it projecting it into my line of sight?
It depends on the size of the
It could conceivably be a pair of glasses almost that you would look through.
Yeah.
But the ones I've been seeing, the display is a bit above the eye line.
Right.
So I guess you would look into it.
Yeah. There's a couple of different ways to do it. One of them is to have it be a smaller display that's focusable. And then there's another way that you can put a contact lens in, mm-hmm. which can change the close focus characteristic of the eye. It doesn't affect any of the far vision at all, but it allows you to put a MEMS display or a micro display very close to the eye, making the coverage much larger. And it will still be in focus. It doesn't require collimating optics. So collimating optics mean lots of little pieces of glass.
Right.
It adds weight. It adds thickness.
Right.
And with the InnoVega, which is the contact lens that you use for the adjusting the close focus, all the collimating problems go away. So I think what we'll see is lots of different configurations sort of being thrown out into the marketplace over the next number of years. And the one that will be adopted more frequently by people will be the one that is the light one, the one that's the lightest, that has the best battery life.
It doesn't make you run into trees.
Highest amount of resolution.
Doesn't make you queasy.
Highest amount of visual coverage.
Right.
You know.
I'd love a heads-up display, though. I'd love to be able to, for instance, look at you and have a display around your face that says, "That's Gregory Panos. You met him in 1983," and
My Wikipedia will
or your Wikipedia
pop up
page.
And it will flow around my face.
Wouldn't that be
so
awesome?
So you don't break eye contact, you see details.
I'm looking straight at you.
That are relevant to me in particular.
Is that doable?
Yeah, I think so. Actually, a friend of mine went to work for Wikipedia and their mobile group, Phil Chang, and we were talking about that. I said, when we get to AR, I said, your job is going to be how to have another mobile app of Wikipedia that's going to be able to format itself dynamically based on the AR system that somebody's wearing and how much information is actually on the page and which are the important parts.
Just as we now mobilize a site for the iPhone and the Android phones, you have to mobilize it for glasses.
Well,
now.
you want some intelligence filtering the information and presenting it to you so you don't have to redirect your attention away from a personal contact or face-to-face communication.
We're talking to a computer graphics wizard, CGI wizard, a virtual reality expert, an augmented reality expert, Greg Panos on triangulation. Did you see the Tupac, the holographic Tupac that
yes.
they did at Coachella.
Yeah.
What did you think of that, and how did they do it?
Well, they reconstructed Tupac Shakur digitally. They made a 3D version of him at very high resolution.
Was it done in a capture suit like I used to use?
Well, yeah, they model him in 3D. They used photographs and other reference mm-hmm. information to create a very accurate model. And then they used a performance capture technology.
So they did have a human doing the move.
Right. They had a human who put on a performance capture suit mm-hmm. and did the moves and the dances. And I don't know whether they also did some of the voice work as well mm-hmm. because he says, "Welcome, Coachella."
Right, right.
And with a few expletives in there. So, and it sounded like him. So,
right.
you know, they got a voice alike at least to do that.
Or, yeah.
And then they also used a projection technology, which is kind of a modified Pepper's Ghost effect, where you have a, it's like a piece of plastic that has very, very, very thin microscopic aluminum lines painted into the plastic so you can see through it. It's semi-transparent, but also has a very high degree of reflection. And then there's a mirror, and then there's a projector that's ahead of the stage, and they can move the projector up and down in this sort of projection box, and that moves the character in and out of the stage depth. So they're either backstage or in the front.
It gives
of the
it
stage.
A 3D feeling.
Yeah, they can give the impression of actual 3D depth in the Z axis mm-hmm. by messing around with the display system, and the other performers that will interact with the character have enough room in front of or behind the display. So
you can see through the display so that they can be behind it?
Right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So they can go around him.
Yeah.
And that's what gives that holographic effect.
Yeah. The Japanese have been using it with the Vocaloid characters.
I've seen that. And that is
Mikuni
the widest, or, wildest thing
yeah,
I've ever
they've
seen.
Yeah, they've been doing live performances for like a year now
yeah,
using
and the kids
technology.
Go crazy
They
for
go
it.
Crazy over it. Yeah, it's very engaging to be in front of a stage and have something like that that's a very sort of innocuous little screen that doesn't really distract you very much, and then it lights up all of a sudden and there's a character there.
Wow. You said you're a futurist. I'd love to, we're going to take a break, but I'd love when we come back to talk about what's next in this arena. Greg Panos is our guest, former president of LA SIGGRAPH, which is the biggest chapter of the special interest groups for
right.
graphics as part of the ACM. And is SIGGRAPH still do conferences? That used to be a really fun
one. Yeah, SIGGRAPH's still a great conference. Oh. I the last 2 days I've been running around NAB, and I keep running into all my SIGGRAPH friends.
This, in many ways, this has become another great conference because of the content creation side
right.
of it. There's so much stuff.
Well,
I
produced a super session in 1999 here at NAB called The Virtualization of Hollywood. And it was an all-day long super session. We had 35 speakers. Doug Trumbull was our keynote. And we had three session topics: virtual sets, virtual props, and virtual actors. So I had experts from each of those fields, and we had over 1,000 people in a room all day long over at the Sands, and it was one of the most successful super sessions they ever had. And NAB has kind of followed the lead on that. John Marino, the Director of Science and Technology for NAB, has been very, very diligent in finding the technology leaders and booking them for sessions and putting special sessions together,
right.
like the Cameron session
right.
and quite a few other ones, you know, since then. So I think NAB will have an augmented reality session.
I hope so.
At some point, I might plan one for
that. That would be cool. Next year, I want to be at that.
Well, there are going to be a lot of applications for AR in broadcasting.
Sure. Oh, think about it.
There aren't any that you can really see here at the show. Epson does have a pretty cool AR visor system that's actually here in South Hall all the way at the end.
Oh, interesting.
It's about $600-$700, but yeah. I tried it on yesterday. It looked great. Yeah. It's a little heavy, but it's full HD. It does 3D. You can either do see-through, or you can put the little cover over it, and it can be occluded.
AR merges into VR.
Right.
Yeah. Augmented reality, which is taking real world and adding data on top of it. Virtual reality, where it's no longer, it's an imaginary world. Or
yeah, virtual reality is distinguished from AR in that you're completely in an immersive world
right.
that
right.
is being fed to you because your visor is being head tracked. So
right.
it knows where you're looking and where your head is positioned. So it corrects the world in real time in order for you to get the impression that you're in a physical space. and you're navigating and looking
around.
In
some ways, augmented reality seems to have more promise because
it's more practical.
It's certainly more practical.
Yeah.
You won't walk into trees with
it. Well, if you look at how many people are just staring at their devices walking around or on their bicycles.
We're in
now.
A VR world when we're staring at our phone.
It'll
no
be easier
yet.
To just have it in your visor.
Yeah, exactly.
And your visor, of course, will be tracking your head position, where you are as far as magnetic north is concerned, how far you're tilted, head up or head down. You saw the glasses at CES like last year where they're like liquid crystal glasses that automatically adjust for presbyopia depending on whether you're looking down or you're...
We thought that was going to be a hot product. I thought they'd be out by now.
It will be. Yeah. All glasses will be like that in a couple of years.
Right.
So it's a new technology, and they're fighting all this old metal and hardware and glass to gain their dominance.
That's
but
right.
I think the AR systems will also have corrective lens accommodation like that as well.
It has to, because I wear glasses.
Right. You don't want to have a...
Glasses on my glasses.
Have to have a visor that only someone that's 22 years old can wear with 22-year-old eyes.
Greg Panos is our guest at Triangulation. More in just a minute, but first I want to tell you about Audible.com. Talk about getting into a virtual world. There is no better way to escape the real world and then enter a virtual world than reading a great book, right? And when you listen to it, it's even more vivid. That's why I love Audible.com. We're just 1 week away from the new Stephen King novel, the latest in his magnum opus, The Dark Tower series, April 24th. That comes out, and actually Audible's giving away copies of it if you listen now to a Stephen King book. So maybe you should pick one of these books, and I'll tell you how you can get it for free in just a moment. And this one looked interesting. I have to say, Audible for me is also an education. I listen to a lot of fiction, but nonfiction is great too. Steven Greenblatt just won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction for this book, The Swerve, How the World Became Modern. You go back to the dawn of the Renaissance. It's a story about a book lover who rescued a Roman philosophical text from certain oblivion. Then what happened next? It's fascinating. And another great choice. See, here's the problem. There's 100,000 titles at Audible.com. They'll play on almost any device, Android, iPhone. Yes, the Windows mobile version's coming soon. And it's just, whether you're at the gym, on a commute, I'm going to be on a plane in a couple of hours, you bet I'll be listening to my Audible book. Audible.com. Now, here's how you can get a free book right now. Go to audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. You'll be signing up for the gold account. That's the book a month account. You get a credit. Almost every book in the library is a credit. Just pick the book you want, download it, put it on your device, start listening. You can cancel at any time and therefore pay nothing if you decide not to stick around. But the book is yours forever anyway. So it's a free book for you just for trying out audible.com. Please do yourself a favor. It's just the best way to kill time and learn something too. audiblepodcast.com/triangulation. We thank Audible so much for their support of our show and our visit to NAB this year. Greg Panos is my guest, graphic expert and futurist. What does the future hold, Greg? Give us a peek.
My future over the next couple of weeks is I'm very excited about going to the ARE 2012 Augmented Reality Conference in San Jose that's coming up.
This is a really big subject right
now,
isn't
it?
Yeah,
I went to the conference last year, and I was very impressed with the quality of the speakers and everybody that was there. And it's May 8th through 9th. It's ARE 2012. If you look it up on the web. I've got some links as well that maybe we could share.
Oh, sure. I'll pull them up. Personalfoundation.com. This is an AR source book.
Yeah, Persona here. Foundation.
A persona, not personal.
.org.
Okay.
/AR source book. That's,
I'll pull this up.
Just the parking place for some links that I put for the show today.
All right.
And but that are AR related. But ARE 2012 is coming up. It's a couple of $100 to attend. Anybody that's serious about augmented reality, getting into augmented reality, learning about it, meeting people that are doing it, should seriously consider going to that conference because it'll be 10 times better than going to SIGGRAPH or any of the other conferences where you'll just see little bits and pieces of AR.
This is it now.
And it's not the prime focus.
Right.
And shortly after that, the NVIDIA has the Emerging Company Summit, which is their annual mini SIGGRAPH event that's up in San Jose. And that's a another great conference to go to if you're interested in the real high end of computer graphics and computer animation and all the things that are being done with the NVIDIA platform. Just amazing. And now they have the Tegra, which is all in the in the smartphones and making them very, very useful for things like AR.
Well, they quite rightly see this as the future for them because it's not just gaming. This they, you can use this high-powered GPU to do things like augmented reality.
That's right. And, yeah, you can lay characters over a real scene. You can lay all kinds of analytic information over a scene.
Paint us a picture. Let's say, I don't know, 5 years from now, and that's not unreasonable in a time frame, I'm wearing maybe their Google glasses, maybe. I'd like to see this, their Apple glasses. What will my vision look like? What will I be looking at as I walk down the street? What kinds of information am I going to be seeing?
Well, you'll at least be able to look people in the eyes without having to be looking away from your whatever
I'll
in
be
your
able
hands.
To, I guess speech recognition is key in this too, isn't it?
Yeah. So they will all have speech recognition. They'll all have eye tracking.
That means they know where you're looking.
Right. Yeah. I mean, ideally.
Yeah.
If you want to build the ultimate AR, wearable AR system, it needs to track your pupil. It needs to understand your voice and have a noise rejection.
You know, I had a very strange experience. I was outside walking between the halls earlier today, and there were at least three of us talking, dictating to our phones.
Right.
And it was a little confusing. Is it going to be a weird world where we're all talking to ourselves into our glasses? I guess it's no different than Bluetooth headsets.
Well, if there, you know, I think people will adopt different kinds of memes for note-taking using that paradigm.
Right.
Where you press a button, you take a note.
Right.
If you have an AR goggle on, you may blink twice and, like, look up to the right, and that says...
That's the signal.
Start taping right now.
Or you may even say, glasses record,
because
they listen all the time, right?
Right.
So you can speak to them.
Yeah, and, you know, Google Voice has transcription capability built in. So you can basically talk and then have the text proofread later on and added to, if you're writing a book or something, you might have some notes or things that just pop into your brain. You're walking along and you just say, you know, take a note, blah, 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 blah. And you do it and it's done, and then you get home and it's all organized for you.
What about face recognition? Isn't that a little controversial?
Well, Google has a great scientist working for them, Hartmut Neven, and he is one of the leaders in visual analytics, and face recognition was one of the problems he tackled early on, and he had a company that actually Jaron Lanier was a partner in got sold to Google, and he went with it and took a director position.
Mm-hmm.
And he's one of the smartest guys they have.
So they are definitely in face recognition, no doubt about
it. Well, yeah. Google Goggles is a product that came out of his lab.
Is it okay if it's opt-in? Maybe that's the solution to say, I flip a switch on my glasses that say that if people want to recognize me with their glasses, they can.
Yeah, I was thinking about it last night. What, you know, what would we do?
Yeah, because some people are legitimately concerned about the privacy
At NAB,
issues.
You know, you've got these...
We're wearing badges. We're announcing who we are all the time.
They have barcodes.
Yep.
So this is all machine readable.
Right.
And you can also, you know, get a QR code pin and, like, put it somewhere up on your lapel.
Just get it tattooed on your forehead and we'll be done with it.
But your AR visor will read the QR code very quickly, and it won't need to go to the web and do a lot of computationally intensive analytical tasks to determine who your face is.
Right.
If your face is like you and I are friends on Facebook, and if
that'd be sufficient to pull up your Facebook page,
it might scrape
great.
My Facebook first, looking for a match before. And if it has help from a QR code, that might be a way to either even accelerate the process or minimize the amount of bandwidth that has to be done walking around.
You've got to think, because of that, Facebook is very much interested in this as well.
Yeah, well, Facebook is an interesting...
They have the data.
Yeah, they're an interesting example of a company that is sort of paddling away trying to figure out what to do in some cases. And some of these technologies are riding so quick on their heels that they don't know whether they want to slow the process down or they want to open it up.
Right.
You know, open up their API and give the information away. I think in the past they weren't very happy about people scraping information from Facebook. But They have a way that people can do it legitimately with their approval, and I think it's going to get to be a point where everyone's just going to need it all the time anyway,
right.
And they're not going to be able to afford to waste a lot of time approving most of it.
Do you think we're going to rapidly get into a situation where there's a kind of a world that is divided between people who embrace these technologies, use them to good effect, and then people who are terrified by them, hate them, feel that they're invasion? It seems like we're going to create a new cast of Luddites with these kinds of technologies.
It will be a very small percentage of individuals that are younger individuals that would not want to adopt the technology.
You think younger, not older?
Yeah, I think I think it's more likely older people might be less inclined to adopt the technology.
Right.
And as we get older, you know, there'll be technologies that you and I clearly understand are beneficial to us.
But we just don't want to
bother with them. Right.
The good news about you and me, Greg, is so far we haven't met those technologies that we didn't like.
Well, yeah, we're kind of in a unique class.
We're unusual that way.
We're still very excited about everything.
Greg has put together a great list of links that has a lot of information about augmented reality on his site. It's personafoundation.org/ARSourcebook. And interesting, because some of the links are about people jumping ship to go to Google, the kinds of people Google
right.
has put together that really kind of do lead me to think that that's absolutely what Google's up to.
Yeah, it's just a list of things, so like the initial Nick Bilton story and then some of the bios for some of the guys that they hired. And
if you get a chance, at the bottom there's a link to Eric Whitaker's Virtual Choir 3.
Right, that's exciting.
And you were telling me about this yesterday, and it's something I'm going to leave us all with, just an amazing choir of 3,746 singers from 73 countries, each of whom recorded themselves on webcam. He collated them into a single song with 3,700 voices. Wow, this is amazing. And here they all are, coming into the room to get ready to sing this song.
Yeah, this was just released.
Yeah.
I encourage everyone to listen to it on a really nice stereo.
EricWhitaker.com, the virtual choir. We're going to leave you now at the NAB show. Stay tuned because the hams are coming up, the ham party.
Great.
Tomorrow, 9 to 11. We're going to continue our coverage. I'm headed back to the brick house because I have a job to do tomorrow. We've got Windows Weekly Security Now and Before You Buy to record. So I'm going to run out and catch a plane. Thank you all for letting us be part of your day and for helping us,
thank you.
Watching us during our NAB coverage. Thank you so much, Greg. It's great to see you again. I'm Leo Laporte. On behalf of everybody at TWIT, thanks for being here. We'll see you next time on Triangulation.